Welcome to Meet the Professors. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. We gathered a group of medical oncologists in community-based practice to present de-identified cases of colorectal cancer to our faculty of Drs. Alan Vanook, Axel Grothy, and Dan Haller. The first case was presented to Dr. Vanook by Dr. Sam Balbrow. The patient was initially diagnosed at age 44 in 1999 with a tumor that had 25 positive lymph nodes.
His final pathology showed a tumor that was well differentiated but 9 centimeters in diameter. It involved a descending colon and tumor infiltrated through the muscular layer into the subserosal fat. Margins were negative. Many lymphovascular tumor emboli were identified and 25 out of 43 lymph nodes were positive for disease. The patient was then referred for adjuvant chemotherapy, and at that time he was treated with 5-FU and leucovorin, and he did well after that until very recently.
He's a very young man. What was his reaction to the diagnosis?
He's a hardworking guy. He's a laborer, and he didn't appreciate what I thought was horrible when I saw 25 positive nodes. A tumor was removed, and I said, look, I think we should give you preventive chemotherapy. That was fine, and he tolerated it beautifully. I treated him in 99 and 2000. First, I saw him every 2 months, 3 months, 4 months. Now it was every 6 months, and he was doing great. I was always amazed. I'd get a CEA. It was negative. I stopped doing CAT scans after a couple of years, and he was fine and went for a screening colonoscopy in March of this year and had a negative screening colonoscopy. But the day after he had abdominal pain, the gastroenterologist got concerned that she might have perfed him and did a CT scan, and lo and behold, he had ureteral obstruction. He had left ureteral obstruction. He had a CT scan which showed lymph nodes in the peripancreatic area and some infiltrative process around the left ureter. He had a percutaneous nephrostomy and then was referred back to me, and I wasn't sure what he had. I wasn't sure whether he had recurrent colon cancer or possibly another malignancy. He was referred to a gastroenterologist who was able to do a transluminal biopsy of one of the lymph nodes. And that showed adenocarcinoma consistent with his colonic carcinoma. It was CDX2 positive, CK20 focally strong positive, and negative for CK7. And he basically feels well, was still working.
Alan, any comments on the time course of recurrence 8-9 years later?
Yeah, so this is the exception that makes the rule.
I know.
There's now a lot of data that even the most vigilant follow-up can probably stop after about 3 years, that the risk of recurrence diminishes dramatically beyond 3 years. Although, as you said, the worst prognostic factor is the percentage of nodes. In 25 of 43 nodes, I mean, you just sort of kept waiting for the other shoe to drop. So this is really odd, but it just goes to the unpredictable biology.
So would you be comfortable, based on what you've heard, saying this guy has recurrence?
The immunostaining is consistent. You'd like to compare that staining to the original tumor, which apparently they may have or may not have done.
They looked at the original tumor. This was actually done at Yale, and they felt that the histology was consistent with his original adenocarcinoma.
How about the markers? Did they do those on the primary?
I don't recall now. But
you know, when a quaxin looks like a duck, so you have a 9-centimeter left colon lesion with 25 positive nodes, he's got nodal recurrence in the left retroperitoneum. I mean, this is certainly compatible, and I would assume that it's colon cancer.
Now, would you want to see a KRAS in him?
Well, ultimately, I would. I think as far as the immediate decision-making, I'm not sure that would alter my decision, but I would like to see the KRAS.
Interesting. So about this patient, how would you sort through options?
Right. So were it open, this patient would be a candidate for CALGB80405, near and dear to my heart.
Which is your trial.
I'm the PI on the study. So this is a 3-arm trial that looks at either FOLFOX or FOLFIRI, that's physician-patient choice, with either bevacizumab, cetuximab, or the combination. That study's closed at the moment, being amended to only include KRAS wild-type patients.
And you're going to keep the combination arm?
We are. There was an independent data safety monitoring assessment. The data from 2 studies, the PACE trial that looked at panitumumab with Avastin, and the CAIRO-2 trial that looked at cetuximab with Avastin with capecitabine-based chemotherapy, neither showed a benefit to the double biologics. but our data safety monitoring board said it was still appropriate to keep it open.
And am I correct in saying that even in KRAS wild patients, I think it was the PACE trial, they still didn't see a benefit of the combination?
That's right. A lot of moving parts in these trials. Panitumumab is a different drug than cetuximab. May have been a dose issue with subtle toxicities, but it may very well be that the double biologics aren't going to be worth the cost, both in dollars, and the study will show that. KRAS2 showed...
KRAS wild type,
there was no delta with a double biologic. There was no difference in outcome.
So now non-protocol approach to this patient.
Right. So I presume if this group is representative of the rest of the country, this patient would have gotten FOLFOX-BEV. My own choice would be FOLFIRI-BEV, just because I happen to think that FOLFIRI and FOLFOX are equivalent. And I think FOLFOX, you're going to be limited by neuropathy. You're going to have a finite amount of time you can use it. And also, albeit a small study, the best outcome of any single arm in any randomized trial to date in colon cancer is FOLFIRI-BEV. That's the big C trial, that arm. So I would start with FOLFIRI-BEV.
So even if this patient was shown to be KRAS wild?
Cetuximab is not approved in first line. So I think...
If it were?
If it were, that would be a reasonable choice. I mean, I think the important question that my study would ultimately answer is in the KRAS wild type patient, is BEV better than cetuximab, or are they a wash? I think in this patient, FOLFOX-BEV, FOLFIRI-BEV, in an asymptomatic guy, and you're not going to cure the disease, given the distribution of the disease with nodal disease, it's unrealistic to think you can cure it. You could equally do single-agent therapy. I think one of the missing pieces is convincing ourselves that you need to pile on up front as opposed to doing sequential therapy.
Which single agent?
I'm not advocating it, but I think the Europeans, in the UK, they did the FOCUS trial, which looked at numerous sequential combinations. The Dutch did KRAS1, which looked at sequences, and the outcomes were the same.
But are you saying, for example, 5-FU-BEV or just
capecitabine alone? I'm not advocating it, but I think if you have an incurable patient, that's not unreasonable. My own approach would be to be aggressive. I think you're looking for the outlier. He had a 9-year disease-free interval. Maybe you can really set the disease back. So I would probably be aggressive. I think there may be the occasional patient who's a long-term survivor with metastatic disease, and I would be aggressive as my default position. But I think you could approach this patient in many different ways.
Does this man have any pain?
No. He actually really was feeling very well.
Can you bring us up to the present?
Sure. He had a CEA that was normal, and his liver function studies and renal function was normal when I saw him. I did treat him with FOLFOX4 plus bevacizumab, and he has tolerated it beautifully without... He's had a little more nausea than I would have expected because I really find the program is well tolerated. Just this week, I did a CAT scan, and it turns out that he is responding to therapy. His nodes are smaller. There seems to be less inflammatory changes around his ureter. I just told him that on the phone 2 days ago and plan to continue therapy, probably to maximum response. That's my approach. I don't know when to stop, but I would, as long as he's tolerating therapy, he doesn't have excessive neuropathy right now, I'll continue therapy for another 3 months and then repeat a CAT scan and try and get the best response I can.
What about long-term options here, Alan?
Right. So a couple of issues, just as a point of preference. If FOLFOX4, we generally find is more toxic than modified FOLFOX6. So we've dropped the day two bolus, but certainly most of the data is with FOLFOX4. I mean, the long-term issues for this patient will be if he's a laborer, he uses his hands, for example, it would be a big deal if he develops a neuropathy. And one of the problems that I think is underappreciated, because I frankly think that it's not reported clearly, is that the incidence of neuropathy, I think, is higher than is reported in literature. And in our experience, the neuropathy often gets worse even after you stop the oxaliplatin. So I would err on the side of not treating this patient to really substantial neuropathy. Again, this is largely, presumably, palliative. I agree with treating to maximal response. I might look in a couple of months, and I'd be really quick to drop the oxaliplatin. I think the harder issue is if you've got somebody with low-volume disease who's plateaued at a response, what do you do? Do you give them an absolute treatment holiday? this is exactly the patient who will get, you'll have that question, because he had a 9-year disease-free interval. So do you give him a total treatment holiday? Do you give maintenance therapy? Do you change to something else? I mean, this is as much driven by the patient's philosophy as it is by the literature.
Would you continue the bevacizumab?
I mean, I think even the bev, it's a tough call. Again, part of it is, could we ever cure this patient? And most of us don't think we can. So you could say, why give bev? Because a response is a response. And if he's got low volume disease, if this guy has a stroke or an MI, you haven't done him a favor. But certainly we give bev because we want to maximize his response. As far as would I keep him on maintenance bev, don't know the answer. I'm a believer in total holidays. I think patients do well if they can get away from the infusion center for a few months at a time. And that would be my approach.
What about the issue of bev on progression? Axel Grothy's paper is going to be published in the JCO with a couple editorials, and of course we'll ask Axel about this. But what about the issue of continuation of bev on progression?
Right. So the theoretical concern with stopping bevacizumab, either when you plateau or when you progress through a chemo regimen on bev and then move to the next chemo regimen, is there sort of a rebound phenomenon from bevacizumab? And VEGF is upregulated, so you get higher levels. So does a tumor accelerate when you stop bevacizumab? And it's a subject of a national study called the IBET trial, which is whether to continue bev or not as you move to the next regimen. I think it's a very hard question and one that will only be answered by that kind of study. Again, my instinct is that long-term bev is probably not to be advised until we have a lot more data on long-term bev, although I've certainly seen patients where I'm convinced their disease just accelerated off of bevacizumab. So I don't know the answer.
Ken?
I'm going to play devil's advocate for a second.
Go for it.
Number one, the patient is asymptomatic. His metastatic disease was found by accident, essentially. It's an iatrogenic mistake, or iatrogenic. Why treat him at all and wait? Because we're certainly not curing him. Mm-hmm. So the question is there any evidence that early treatment is going to make a difference with respect to survival, quality of life, maintenance of performance status? Secondly, the patient has locally recurrent disease. He is a slow grower. This disease probably has been there for years. Why not use something like radiation therapy for local control with Zoloda or without Zoloda, and then save your big guns for when disease goes to liver?
Perfectly reasonable. Good questions. As I said at the outset, this is a patient where you could sequence with simpler chemotherapy. There is data predating the oxaliplatin, irinotecan, bevacizumab, cetuximab era that waiting until symptoms is not a winning strategy, but that's very old data. It hasn't and won't be done in current practice. But I think your question is fair, and I would argue this patient actually was symptomatic, didn't know it, but he had an obstructed ureter. And so we all know retroperitoneal adenopathy can progress and could have caused more problems. So I think it's a really valid question. If it was just nodal disease without an obstructed ureter, I think that would have been in play as to whether you want to treat now or later. I am not
treat
a fan.
Without symptoms, though, for example, if there were just nodal disease,
right. So,
do you radiate?
Well, let me get to radiation in a minute. I think the dilemma for all of us as oncologists is we certainly think that nodal disease is not curable. I mean, that's our instinct, and it probably is true. But I can tell you I've got long-term survivors who had nodal-only disease who were treated aggressively. Now, there aren't many of them, and I think we have to be careful that the old paradigm doesn't affect what we do now. Probably these are still incurable patients. But I would argue that if you're going to make a difference with the aggressive therapy, you may make the biggest difference in the low-volume patient where maybe you can eradicate it. So very valid points. Now, in terms of radiation, I prefer not to do radiation in these patients. This is a big field. You're going to hit a ton of small bowel, and I think radiation is going to open up another can of worms. So I wouldn't do radiation, but I think the others are perfectly reasonable. Sequence, don't treat. If it was an 85-year-old, I probably would say, look, let's just watch it.
Sam?
Yeah, 2 points. One is that the nodes were mesenteric nodes, not retroperitoneal.
Oh, okay.
So I was more concerned about his nodes. and he's only 53. And I felt the way you did, that I wanted to give him one trial of aggressive therapy, and knowing that I'm not going to cure him, but I can always step back and use Zoloder or 5-FU at some point when I want to be less aggressive in the future.
I think these are questions that we all ask because we go through a differential and we have to say, why not do X versus Y? And it's nice to know the literature and the X. You know.
Well, and I think that, frankly, it's much clearer to me with the isolated liver met in terms of whether you have realistic goals, because curiously, you can cure that patient, and this patient probably you can't cure.
One final wrap-up point, because it's probably the biggest question in colorectal cancer right now, which is, again, first-line therapy in the KRAS wild patient. What is your perception of the investigator community right now? Do you think in general people are still using FOLFOX Bev even in the wild patient?
I think, again, it's a study question. I would bet that if you enrich the population for KRAS wild type, that you'll have at least equivalent, if not perhaps a slightly better response rate with cetuximab with the chemotherapy backbone. I think the place for cetuximab rather than Bev might be in the resectable liver met patient, where the timing of Bev, the timing of surgery is a big issue. So you use chemo Bev in a resectable patient, you have to wait 6 or 8 weeks from your last dose of Bev before you can do a liver resection. So that, in my view, might be the patient where upfront chemo with cetuximab makes sense.